People taping, right?
It's video.
Okay. Today is January 23rd. We are taping Jewish Public Policy. This is our first class, and we're doing an introduction on the reasons for the mitzvahs and how we determine public policy based on our mitzvah sources. So the question is, to go all the way back to the revelation of our public policy, if you will, which ostensibly begins with Har Sinai. So we start our nationhood as slaves, and immediately upon attaining our freedom, God gives us a list of commandments to remember that slavery. That's not our main revelation, that the list of those commandments: bring a korban pesach, eat matzah and maror, don't eat chametz. This is to make sure that we do not ever forget what that slavery meant to us. A slave only is interested in surviving to another day. There's no incentive to do more or to make more. It's the same day whether I was lazy or the same day whether I was productive. I'm not getting a raise because I did a better job today or I made more bricks. So a slave just wants to get through the day. Right? So when we receive our freedom, the Torah says, you're not an animal, you're not a beast of burden, you are a human being. I want you to use your creativity now and do your best, the best of what you have, to be productive for yourself, to be productive for others, to be productive for God, but not for something that goes for naught. Right? This might be why the first mitzvah we get immediately after all of this is Pidyon HaBen, Pidyon Bechor, Kadesh Likol Bechor. And why, when the first words that Moshe said to Paro was, B'ni Bechori Yisrael, my Bechor is Israel. The Bechor represents giving your best. Bechor is your first. It's something that's what Kayin misunderstood this when he just brought me Pri Ha'adama. Hevel brings me Bechorot Tzono Mezel Behem. Right, so we're going to see that shortly also in respect to competition. These boys are competing for something. And that led to a real problem, led to murder. But for now, we immediately upon leaving Egypt, God says, I want you to use your creativity. And the order of what happens after we leave Egypt, which really isn't complete until the sea is split and the Egyptians drown there, right? So the first order of business is Ma'amad Har Sinai. Revelation. Okay? That revelation comes with 10 dibrot, right, that are largely not ritualistic. There's only one ritual involved, is observance of Shabbat. Right? And then comes Mishpatim. And then comes building a Mishkan. Okay? These three statements, Ma'amad Har Sinai, Mishpatim, and then the Mishkan, will go a long way towards us understanding what we're doing with this course. What determines Jewish public policy? The Torah is creating public policy at the end of Sefer Shemot, after we leave Egypt, from the middle to the end. And here's what I would suggest to you. Is that human being is obviously has very serious materialistic needs, right? We need to eat, we need to drink, we need to have social needs, we need to be part of a group, we need to feel validated. We have various needs, right? The Torah wants to teach us that you also have some spiritual needs. Those needs could be manifest in numerous ways, but you're more than just an animal, right? I hold you responsible. I will judge you. I will be judgmental to you, and I will punish you if you don't size up. Okay. So this is where I'd like to explain this progression. Ma'amad Har Sinai, I reveal myself to you. This is what I am. I just took you out of Egypt, no fish and no ketchup. I share a taste of America's Mitzrayim. I have certain expectations from you. But then that moves very quickly to civil law. And here is the basic thrust of this introduction. The purpose of civil law for the Israelite at this time is very different than the same purpose for an Egyptian, Sumerian, Babylonian. I'm not saying this because I'm the Jew and I like the Torah more than what it was to be an Egyptian at the time. I'm just telling you what is open for any study, any student who wants to learn what law did you follow if you were a Sumerian at the time that we left Egypt. Because they had elaborate law codes too. The Egyptians did, the Babylonians did, the Sumerians did, the ancient civilizations that many of us probably did too. The Ugarites probably did too, but we don't have the fullness of their law codes. So the three I just mentioned, Sumeria, Babylonia, and Egypt, we have significant law codes from these places. And I must tell you, between the three, every single mitzvah that's in Parshas Mishpatim about civil law is contained. It's understood. If you were living 3,500 years ago, you also have to make sure that oxen don't gore, that people don't dig pits where someone can fall in and hurt themselves, that people are, or if they do, they'll be punished, that they don't light a fire that will spread this up to someone else's land and cause damage. All of Bava Kamma, Bava Metzia, and Bava Basra is included in these law codes. Of course, not as elaborate, but they're all there. If not all of Bava Basra, Bava Kamma, Bava Metzia, Bava Basra, then certainly all of Parshas Mishpatim. They have civil law too, right? But there's a very big difference between their civil law and our civil law, and this is as follows. And this is explicit in their writings. The purpose of a civil society in Bavel, in Egypt, is so that we can have an orderly civilization where we can serve our God or gods and be as powerful as we need to be in order to win our next war, and that our gods assure us a good harvest next year, and that our children are born healthy, etc., etc., the things anybody wants. But their purpose of civil society has nothing to do with the individual value like the Torah places on us. The Torah's public policy, as I'll show you as we go on, and as is manifest in Parshas Mishpatim especially, is that each and every individual is in God's image. We're going to have some business to do later in the semester, whether we feel that's true, whether you are a member of our system, or that's true of people outside of the Israelite system. You know what I'm saying? Right? Do we believe that an Egyptian is any less a Tzelem Elokim than someone who is in our system? So we'll discuss that, comes up a little later in the semester. But for now, we'll see that our public policy is framed around the notion that the civil law is meant to instill within its adherents. And its members, that you have infinite value in yourself. This manifests itself in what seems to be illogical, that if someone would come into this room and say, you have 5 seconds, give me one of these boys or I will kill all of them. And here it's a mission in Maseches Trumas. I can't. Not allowed. Because every one of you is an entire world. And it's illogical. They're all going to die anyway. Right? Now, one person can volunteer. Right? But I can't make that choice because not one of you is a rodent. Not one of you is threatening anybody else. He is. Right? It's so illogical. Come on! Just do some... By the way, there are some Rishonim that say what you can do, don't choose a rodent, but do this. The one whose birthday is next from today, that's the guy who's going out. Right? Because that's random. I'm not choosing any one of you to save everybody else. Are you following? All right, but even that's an extremely debatable question. But the point of our civil law is to demonstrate that each and every one of you is a world unto yourself, and that there will be a practical nafka mina when pasken halacha based on that. Yes.
And if we're not, you say a person's allowed to choose that they're the person to do it. How's that any different from like a person who chooses to be a forbidden donor that's essentially quote unquote killing themselves halachically for the sake of others?
It's organ donation is one of our discussions, right? And there was a study that I think it's a Penn some years back about that could not determine why we shouldn't just at random kill people to save 12 other lives, use his heart, use his lung, right?
I mean, organ donation is specifically a choice of yourself. And like I think in another class we discussed that, like, you're not allowed
your life. Your life is not yours either.
Yeah, so how would that be any different than a situation where a bunch of people are going to die and you're choosing to give yourself it?
And you see, there's a little bit of a difference. The people who are getting your organs, right, are not being threatened by you. But potentially, every person in this room is a threat to everybody else based on the way they're framing this. By the way, there are books. There's a book about tshuvas from the Holocaust. The Nazis were aware of this, and they often did things like this. Give me one of your kids, or I'll, you know. In the end, most people probably just gave up the one. Made that choice of, you know. But the halacha, so a lot of this is in theory, meant to be in practice, but the theory is what I'm talking about here, which is that, you ever hear the saying, kol ha-mekayim nefesh achas, ki-ilu ki-ev kol ha-olam kula. If you save one life, which is the original source, by the way, if you save one life, then somehow it became, somehow kol ha-mekayim nefesh achas, which makes word in some of the sources, Yisrael, how that word Yisrael crept in is questionable. Because the original source, which is the Mishnah of the Sefer Sanhedrin, the Mamaches, the whole point of the Mishnah is trying to explain why Adam was created alone. To teach that if someone had killed Adam, we would have had, the whole world would have been destroyed. To teach that, it has nothing to do with Yisrael. Adam wasn't Yisrael, right? We'll, that also comes up later in the semester. So let's take a look at what's going on next. We have civil law, whose purpose is to teach the value of each individual. This will explain why. And now I just want to expose you. This is not, you're not, I just want you to be aware of this name of this book. It's called Toldot Emunat Yisrael, which is a six-volume book in Hebrew written by a man named Yechezkel Kaufman. If you've studied some of the Chama Leibowitz studies on the Parsha, she quotes him, you know, often enough. Maybe you've heard of him. Yechezkel Kaufman, Toldot Emunat Israel. Full disclosure, it's not written from a traditional standpoint, but it's been translated into one volume called The History of the Israelite People, and it compares the Torah to over 100 ancient religions. I just told you three law codes, Egypt, Babylonia, and Sumeria. He got material from sometimes a little bit, but he compares the Torah to over 100 ancient religions. I must confess, when I say Ein Kelokeinu, right, on Shabbos, there is none like our God, right? And then the next line is, Mi Kelokeinu, who is like our God? So shouldn't we ask those questions in the opposite order? Right? We should first say, me, who is like our God? Oh, let me give you the answer. There is none like our God. So why don't we say Ein Kelokeinu before Mi Kelokeinu? Really, it's a klutz kasha. That whole prayer was written to give the Rosh Tevos Omein Baruch Atah, to teach you it's Shabbos today, we're not making so many brachas. Eat a lot of fruit so that you can say more Omeins and brachas. So if you have to say the Aleph, because in the word Omein, Aleph comes before the man, right? So it's a klutz kasha, but in the theme of what I want to tell you now is that it is perfectly legitimate to ask a very complicated question that you usually give to a 7-year-old boy at the end of davening, Mi Kelokeinu, right? That's Yisro. Yisro is, now I know there's no God like the God of Israel. So the Gemara says he worshipped every god in the world, right? To know that God, that Moshe's God was greater. Otherwise, how could he say such a thing? Maybe there is a God greater than Moshe's God. You just haven't met him yet. Right? So it's perfectly legitimate to ask the question, Mi Kelokeinu, but first you better be sure, because it may drive you to heresy, unless you have a firm standing that your conclusion is going to be Ein Kelokeinu. You could say, so what's the point of such an endeavor? Right? Well, because I don't want to end up a heretic. So first let me have my strong footing. I wouldn't teach this course in seventh grade. I'm teaching the course to people who've been to Israel. You have a strong footing, you know who you are. And if you have your doubts, ask about them. Right? Okay. This book called Toldot Emunat Yisrael points to some significant differences between Parshas Mishpatim and the whole rest of ancient what we call cuneiform law. Right? For one, listen to this. It's very interesting. There's no culture in the ancient world that has the death penalty for kidnapping. Why is the Torah so much more machmir on the kidnapper? There's no modern society that has, crazy places like North Korea where you can get the death penalty for stealing a banner from a hotel. But I'm talking about, just law, let's say. The Torah says the death penalty for kidnapping. Why? What's the difference? So he's doing some differences, some benchmark differences. The Torah has the death penalty for kidnapping. Remember, the people looking at this law just left 400 years of subjugation and their denial of liberty. Now you're free and you're going to deny it from someone else? You're dead. Right? The punishment is a function of how serious we consider the crime. But if you look at kidnapping as a denial of the liberty of God's image, how dare you incarcerate this person against his will and then sell him? You have to sell him also to someone else. You deny his liberty, you lock him behind the door, and then you actually sell him or you use him. You use him yourself as a slave. That person has committed murder. Right. So he wants to show how the individual is so paramount. Plus, there's another thing. In these law codes of these other nations, you have to create like a bingo card. What is this? You have to see who committed the crime. And who was the crime committed against to figure out the punishment? Some societies had five or more social states or statuses, right? You start off at one means you're a nobleman, right? Five means you're a peasant or a slave or something, right? So a one who commits a crime against a five, right, you get a slap on the wrist. A five who commits a crime against a two or a one, they'll kill him for a minor crime. You get it? And so it's very elaborate to figure out who committed the crime, who was the crime committed against. You following? According to the Torah, that very often in the Torah it says, Torah echos yelochem, belager hagor misochem. There's one Torah for all of you. Again, later there's a week where we talk about when the Torah speaks about the ger. What ger are we talking about? A ger toshav or a ger tzedek? Ger tzedek means he converted to Judaism. Ger toshav means he's just a Christian or a Muslim or a Canaanite or an Aramean living in your midst. Right? I know that there's a difference between the two. The Torah says if you have treif meat, give it to a ger. That's a ger toshav. You wouldn't give treif meat to a ger tzedek. It said it means a convert. You're not going to give treif meat to a convert. Right? The gift said it means he's ger, he's gor, he lives in your midst. He's not keeping your Torah. Right? So we'll discuss where it means one. Like the Torah says, love the ger. Which ger are we talking about there? Right? We'll see some very interesting opinions coming out of that. All right, so here, again, every individual is God's image. It doesn't matter whether you make $50 a year or whether you make $50 million a year. It's the same crime if you against either one of them. But not in Egypt or Samaria. Okay? You have to make a chart Who's the crime? Because to them, it's then they're not in God's image. The guy who makes $50 million is so much more valuable to society because he has the wherewithal to serve the God and give him more wine and give him more grain and give him more of his children because he can afford to have many others in order to strengthen the God to make our next war more successful. That guy is more valuable. They don't have any hasaga of Tzelem Elokim. Following? Yes.
How does this fit in with the fact that like Kohanim would have different rules or like a bus?
That's I know, but that is true. That I was going to mention Kohanim, but it's the same. Kohanim or David Melech Yisrael, who commits the same crime, gets the same punishment as the lowest of the shifra. It's the same. You know that's Torah Chas Yelochem. That's very important pasuk. Right, but it's true. There are different stations, some of which were not because you strove for it. Right, this guy was born a Kohen. All right, he's born a Levi. Okay, there are some things like that. Correct. Okay. All right, that's crucial. Right. One other difference. So I just used one specific mitzvah that Calvin mentions, which is kidnapping. One this rule. And now I'd like to introduce you to two words. One is called apodictic law. One is called casuistic law. Okay? Apodictic law, casuistic law. The Torah contains both. Ancient cuneiform law, which is what we're describing here, right? This Sumeric or Babylonian. Right? The ancient cuneiform law only has casuistic law. Let me explain the difference between the two in order to appreciate what I just said. Casuistic law is what Mishpatim is, admittedly. Practically the whole first half of the parsha is casuistic law, which means it says if a person falls into a pit that you dug and damage is caused, you pay a certain amount and you look for the seventh of common, the fifth parak, and you learn all about it. If you started a fire in your backyard and caught on to some thorns and it lit into the next backyard and it did damage to his house or his backyard, then pay damages. Right? If a man sleeps with a woman who is engaged to another man, this is what you should do. Casuistic law starts with a situation. Such a situation happened, this is how you react to it. Okay? Admittedly, in much of these Baba Kama cases, the Torah is casuistic as well. What would be apodictic law of these things I just mentioned? Don't light a fire in your backyard on a windy day. Don't dig a pit in the public square. You get it? When it comes to the engaged girl, there isn't an apodictic law. The Torah says in Parshas Acharemos, don't sleep with an engaged woman. Okay? Casuistic law responds to a situation. It does not prescribe behavior. I mean, you could say, well, if you tell me, if you light a fire on a windy day and it catches thorns, isn't that the same thing as not lighting a fire? Oh, you're allowed to light a fire on a windy day. Just what you have to do. If you don't want to be fined for lighting the gas, take precautions. You're allowed to dig a pit in the public square if you have a purpose for doing so. Just take precautions. Put a big slab of steel or wood on top of it so no one falls in. Right? You get it? The ancient codes only have casuistic law. There is no code of Hammurabi that says, don't kill. It just says, if you kill, another fascinating thing, this goes totally to the core of what we're saying here. In the ancient world, there's hardly ever a death penalty across the board for killing. You can almost always buy yourself off of a death penalty for killing. And they think that they're more just for doing so. Right? If a man kills his neighbor, right, then in almost all ancient codes, you can sue the man and say, and you have the decision, if you pay us $1 million, we'll forgive your death penalty, right? The Torah says explicitly, you may not buy yourself off of a murder rap. The only way to get out is to prove that you didn't do it. Get a good get Rabbi Kiva to get you off. But the if you took a Tzelem Elokim, there's no money that can make up that an innocent Tzelem Elokim. Yes.
So the Torah will contain both apodictic law and
useful. Yes. An example of, let's say, casuistic apodictic law would be put a fence around your roof so that no one falls.
Like,
that's apodictic. Casuistic would be if someone on your roof falls because you didn't have a fence, this is what you should do. But that is not framed casuistically, it's framed apodictically.
So what would be an example, like a Torah example of each?
Well, most of Parshas Mishpatim is framed casuistically. We just got our freedom. Yeah. Our law is going to be framed like a cuneiform law.
Okay.
If you lit a fire and the wind blew it to your neighbors, then you have to pay him damages. Okay. Apodictic would be don't light a fire on a day where you know it's windy and can light fire to your neighbor. So, mein haf kamina, what difference does this make? The Torah wants to prescribe behavior. It wants to teach us how to behave. It's not interested just in an orderly society where I want you to behave this way because you fear the punishment. I want you to improve yourselves. God is also interested in a well-running society where you'll win your next war. But I want you to do that because you are perfecting yourselves. That's Jewish public policy. Better individuals. Now let me get to the Mishkan here, and in so doing, I take you to an amazing pasuk. Anyone here have a mitzvah parsha Tzav? Tzav, okay. Only about two times a century does Tzav's actual haftorah get written. Right. Because it's 80% of the time Shabbos Ebedot. And it's about 19% of the time, or 18% of the time in the leap year, it's going to be Shabbos Parsha Zohar before Purim. So your Haftorah is going to be from Malachi, or Parsha Zohar is going to be from Shmuel Aleph, but the real Haftorah is from Yirmiyahu. Yirmiyahu chapter 7 begins with this pasuk. It's amazing. Tzav, you're reading about Korbanos, and the first words of the Haftorah says, Olo Seichem Sfu Al Zibchechem Beichlu Basor. Put your olos, which the Torah says if you eat you get the death penalty. Put your olos together with your other korbanos and eat the meat. Yirmiyahu is, this is Zaken Mamre territory. He's telling us to eat the meat of olos. The Torah has the death penalty for that. Mina Shamayim, not Yudea Adam. What is a Navi telling us to violate something that's essential to the Torah? Eat your olos? An olos, a burnt offering on the Mizbeach. Even the Kohanim don't eat olos. And Yirmiyahu is telling everybody, eat your olos. And then he says something even more outrageous. Now I'm not going to write it down. I'm going to say it to you. He says, Ki lo dibarti es avoseichem biyom hotzi osam me'eretz mitzrayim al divrei olavazam. I did not tell your ancestors the day I took them out of Egypt about divrei olavazavach, about bringing korbanos. And Yirmiyahu, come on. This is really fucking mamre. You're telling me that there's nothing about korbanos in the Torah? What's Sefer Vayikra? What's the parsha you just read? You just read about korbanos. Now you have the Haftorah tells me that the Novi says God didn't tell you about korbanos when he took you out of Egypt? What are you talking about? So here is another crucial point of the difference that creates Jewish public policy. To the ancient pagan, the ritual was much more important than the civil law. Ritual was much more crucial. I'm not saying that rituals are not crucial to us. We have a Mishkan too. We have tzitzis and tefillin and shofar and lulav and esrog and shechita and kashrus and Shabbos and holidays. Those are all rituals. Those are all rituals, and those are important to us, no doubt. But Yirmiyahu is saying, as many other Nevi'im do, I'm sure you're familiar, Yishayahu says this, Hosea, Amos, Micha, that you have lost the forest for the trees. You are making the rituals to be more important than civil law, and that's simply not true. Yirmiyahu is telling us here that civil law is more important than rituals. Because, listen carefully again, see if you can make the diuk. This is a diuk of the Kli Yakar in Parshas Mishpatim. He says, Ki lo dibarti es avosechem, I did not tell your parents, Biyom hotzi osam me'eretz Mitzrayim, al dibre olav azavach. When I took them out of Egypt, I did not tell them about an institution of kabbalas. I just told them about Korban Pesach, and that was not meant to be an institution. That was meant to wean you off of the Egyptian gods. The Egyptians worshipped the ram. I want you to slaughter that ram. I want you to dab its blood on the doorpost. I want you to prepare it in a way that makes the Egyptians smell it. That's why we have to roast the Korban Pesach, because that makes it smell the most. You roast it whole so they can see it. Any Jew who refused to do this doesn't deserve to leave Egypt. This is your way of showing an in-your-face disgrace about the Egyptians and what they worship. Right? This is your way to make a clean break from what the Egyptians were. You got it? That wasn't an institution. That was just a way for you to get Egypt behind you. So what's the first thing I did with you? I revealed myself to you. Haman Har Sinai. Then I taught you Mishpatim. Only after that did you build a Mishkan with Kavanos. So get it. Listen again. Lo dibarti esavosechem biyom hotzio samiyot mitrayim al diri olav azavach. I gave them mishpatim first. That's a big chiddush. No other nation has such a thing. That civil law is more important to the God than serving Him. That's a point we make midrashically, where Avram Avinu is sitting in front of his tent receiving a divine visit, and he pushes off that divine visit. Get it? If you remember nothing else from this course but that this beautiful point of Avram Avinu pushing off a divine visit so that he can entertain three perfect strangers who the Talmud tells us Avram thought were idolaters, right? Three perfect strangers, and he pushes off the divine visit, and the God doesn't zap him with a lightning bolt. Because you could be sure as much as you're sitting here that that's what would happen to us in the Sumerian story. You dare push off a divine visit to help people? You're crazy. You can't do that. Your God will kill you for that. You following? And when the rabbis read this story in Parshas Vayera, you all know what I'm talking about, what's their reaction? I think one of the most beautiful single statements in the entire corpus of Jewish literature, which is, Gedola Achnosas. Did anyone finish this? Orchen, Me'apolas, Me'ashkin. Inviting company is greater than receiving a divine visit. Wow. What could be greater than receiving a divine visit? How many of you have had a divine visit? Right? Well, you could do better. You could invite company. Wow. Okay. So, everything I just told you in the last 15 minutes can be found in this pasuk. Do it for me, please. Ve'ele ha-mishpatim asher tosim lifnehem. Darshan this word for me to give this message. Ve'ele ha-mishpatim, these are the statutes. This is the civil law that you shall place before them. Explain that lifnehem, midrashim. What does lifnehem refer to? Lifnei Jewish courts. Lifnei Israel. What do you say? Someone say what?
Jewish courts, not the Orthodox.
Okay, that's Rashi. Okay, but lifnei. But what, to bring home my point, what comes right after Parshas Mishpatim in the Torah? What's in Truma Tzavah Kisisa VaYakov Kudav Yitzchak Shmini? Eight parshios. What's the main point of those eight parshios? The Mishkan. Kabbalas, right? Don't you see it? The Eile HaMishpatim Asher Tosim Lifnei Kabbalas. Kabbalas looks feminine, but it's a masculine word. The Eile HaMishpatim Asher Tosim Lifnei Kabbalas. I taught you Mishpatim before I taught those other parshios. Right? That's what Yirmiyahu is saying. Not that I've never taught you about Korbanos. Open up a Sefer Vayikra. You can see it's all about Korbanos. But I didn't teach you Korbanos first. Kilo Dibartius, I didn't tell your parents when they left Egypt about Korbanos. I taught them about civil law first. So you guys, who are so scrupulous in your Ben Adam LaMakom, but your Ben Adam LaChavero stinks, I'm going to come out against that. That's a uniquely Israelite gift to the world. To teach the world that God cares more. And I'll tell you, as a parent, what bothers me more? If my kid doesn't listen to me, I said, listen, be back at 11 o'clock, that's your curfew, and they come at 11:30. Or if a child of mine is cruel to another child. Why didn't you invite them? Why wouldn't you? Right? I can live, I'm a big boy. You didn't come home in time, all right. But when you're not right to each other, you hear? That hurts a parent more. I'm just using this as a figurative sense that what bothers God more? When we didn't listen to him, all right, I didn't wear tefillin today, okay, but... Now, look, I don't mean to skimp on any one of these, but it's a uniquely prophetic approach of the Yirmiyahu's, the Yeshayahu's, the Micha. But I think the Reform movement made a very serious tactical mistake by saying that we know what they did in the 1850s, 1830s, they reformed Judaism, fine. But they attributed their position, guys, come on, almost finished, to Yeshayahu and Amos and Micha and Hosea. They said the Reform movement is where Yeshayahu would want us to be today. Civil law, that's the main thing. Not these rituals. Ugh, kashrus. The first Reform smicha in 1879 in Cincinnati served only shellfish, pork, and trade food. And that's where the conservative movement was created in America, to conserve what Reform was giving up. Right? They said rituals and nonsense. They even wanted to give up bris milah. That's sort of stuck because Americans were circumcising themselves. But it was crazy. They said the only important is the humanistic approach of Judaism. That's our gift to the world, and that's what Yeshayahu would be. That's disingenuous. They didn't read enough of Yeshayahu. Yeshayahu has plenty of rituals in his book, as does Amos, as does Micha. They're just saying that the rituals aren't as important as the civil law. That's legitimate. I can get there, right? But to say that that means that the rituals are not important at all, that's a mistake. Okay. All right, so just to review, I mentioned the Cheskel Kaufman and his understanding of the difference between the ancient Near Eastern law codes and the Torah's approach to law. With apodictic, casuistic, we did a specific example of kidnapping, how crucial each individual is. Sometimes it's not even logical. Like we get the example of saving one or saving everybody or letting one go. Right? So what's left for this for Thursday has to do with the pages 1 through 11 in the Choveret, which I gave you three different approaches. Ramban, Sefer HaChinuch, and which is the reasons for the mitzvahs. The cat's out of the bag. The reasons for the mitzvahs is to perfect us individually. All three of them, maybe in some slightly different ways, all three of them basically say the point of the mitzvahs is different than the public policy framed by a Sumerian 3,000 years ago. It'll end up being an orderly society, but its main goal is to perfect the individual because you are in God's image. That is a theme that will show up all over this course. Now, but if you have a grandparent who's in the hospital right now, that hospital can't wait to get them out of there. And they're probably thrusting in front of your parents' forms about donating their organs. Right? After all, we have a young person who needs that bed. Right? We feel that a tzelem elokim doesn't matter if they're 90 and had a full life or they're 9 and not yet had a full life. And we make certain decisions based on this. Right? I'm not saying that we have to prolong death when the person is already dead on a respirator. But that a lot of our decisions over this semester will have to do with this one introductory point I made today, which is the perfection of the individual, and that individual is something that, for instance, for us, civil law is like ritual. You get the point? Breaking a civil law is like eating on kosher. Right? Now, it depends how you're raised. I think if when you become parents of young children who are having tantrums, here's the rule of all tantrums. Maybe you remember one when you made one yourself. The tantrum will continue as long as you feel the tantrum will get you what you want. As soon as you are 100% sure that whatever happens, this tantrum is not going to get me what I want, the tantrum will end. There's no point to it. A two-year-old gets that. Right? So if your two-year-old says, I want to have ice cream, or they're in the supermarket and they say, I want to have that cereal. So the parent can say, you can't have that cereal, it's loaded with sugar, and you already have diabetic tendencies, and you're already 15 pounds overweight. None of that is going to work with a four-year-old or a six-year-old, but you can tell them it's not kosher. And in our household, kosher is not negotiable. And they'll get that. They'll get that. I just came back from Israel with our grandchildren. One of a three-year-old wanted ice cream, and I reminded him, you just did Fleishitz 2 hours ago. You're still Fleishitz. Again, finished. Fleishitz and Milchitz is not negotiable in this house. Right? So that's the beauty of how an observant Jew raises kids. You know what's negotiable and what's not. So hopefully they'll also grow up and say, I'm sitting at the table and I hear a friend being disparaged. And you know what? Lashon Hara is not negotiable around here. I closed with a beautiful point. A girl I just recently converted asked me to set her up with someone for lunch, Shabbos at dinner. So she stayed with a bunch of friends. And she comes over to me looking very morose at Shalashos. And she said, I have a problem. I heard Lashon Hara at lunch today. Does that mean the food wasn't kosher? Now, she didn't think that Lashon Hara sprinkles over the food and makes a trick. No. She explained herself. If the parent of that household is not careful with Lashon Hara, does that mean that they're also not careful with kashrus? It's a beautiful, beautifully innocent statement to make, right? So I had to, to explain to her, okay, maybe they didn't understand the nuances, they didn't reach me as a Lashon. Okay, that's it. All right, so next class I'm going to go into the Rambam, the Ramban, and the Sefer Chinuch, although basically they said what we did here today. All right? Okay, I will let you know we're not going to, assignments are not going to be due for, we're going to be a little leeway on this. So this is yours?